Welcome, ghouls and goblins, to the 2013 Solomonster Sounds of Halloween special. Sit back, relax, enjoy some zombie brains. Here's your host, the man of the hour, that handsome devil himself, the Solomonster.
Thank you, zombie Solomonster. You really think I'm handsome?
Well, no, it's in the script that you gave me. It says it right here, handsome devil.
Never mind. This is episode 298, special Halloween edition of the Solomonster Sounds Off. Exclusively on the Solomonster.com, Stitcher Radio, and iTunes. I am the Solomonster. It is Sunday, October 27th, 2013. Hell in a Cell Sunday for WWE. Big pay-per-view coming up tonight. We're going to run that down in just a second. But first, just want to mention, we have a Sound Off Superstore, solomonster.spreadshirt.com. We have a bunch of t-shirts up there, iPhone cases and the like. So if you haven't gotten your official Sound Off logo shirt or your Total Nonstop Absurdity t-shirt, those are up in all kinds of sizes and colors. There'll be new stuff going up in the weeks to come. So please support the show by buying a shirt. Or you can make a PayPal donation directly to the show at thesolomonster.com. You'll see the little PayPal donate box on the right-hand side. Give what you can. Every little bit helps. I want to say thank you to Jack Williams, Rob Sutter, and Oscar Nino for their generous donations this week. I very much appreciate that. So please consider doing that. Hell in a Cell, tonight, on pay-per-view. Second pay-per-view of the month for WWE. Probably one pay-per-view too many, but this lineup on paper looks pretty good. They've got a lot of goodwill they're going to have to try to build back up after the finish of that Battleground atrocity earlier this month. On my birthday, no less. What a horrible birthday gift WWE gave me. We know that Dolph Ziggler, for those of you wondering, where is Dolph? Is he even going to be on the show tonight? Well, he will be, but he will not be in the ring. Dolph Ziggler will be joining R-Truth and Caitlyn as analysts for the show. Yes, Dolph Ziggler will be on the pay-per-view as an analyst. Can't have him wrestling for the World Heavyweight Championship. Oh, no. We got to keep that spot open for John Cena in his first match back. So Dolph will be giving us his expertise. And Dolph has a tendency to, I don't want to say shoot, that's not the right word, but he could be very blunt. It's almost like he doesn't care. He'll say what's on his mind. I think it could be very interesting to see if he drops any little comments on the show tonight, but that's what he'll be doing. Let's run through the card here really quick. We'll start from the bottom and work our way up. We have a pre-show match, Hell in a Cell kickoff. Curtis Axel defending the Intercontinental Championship against Big E Langston. I saw an item just before I started recording here where that match was no longer listed on the WWE website, so I don't know if that was just an oversight, if they've changed their minds. Assuming the match does happen, I got Big E Langston. I think Langston goes over. I think Langston wins the Intercontinental title, certainly at some point soon, if not tonight. But he's my pick. Axel has been a complete bust as the Intercontinental Champion. He's, you know, still with Paul Heyman. Maybe over time they could still get him over to a respectable level, but they've done Axel no favors. Even though they put the title on him, they put him with Paul Heyman, all these wonderful things you think would kickstart his career, and he's really gotten nowhere. And Big E Langston, on the other hand, I think has a great deal of potential as a babyface, and I think putting the Intercontinental title on him and giving him a strong run, I mean, that belt has been poison to a lot of the people that have held it recently. If they take a different approach with Langston, I think he could get over big. I wouldn't want to put the title on Langston and start jobbing him out every week. So anyway, he's my pick. Real Americans against Los Matadores. I'm going to go with Los Matadores here. Not that this feud is going to be one and done in one night, but Matadores so far are undefeated, which is not hard, given that I think every match except maybe one that they've had, that one SmackDown match against Ricardo Rodriguez under a mask with Tyson Kidd under a mask. Other than them, I don't know that the Matadores have faced any other team but 3MB. And maybe on main event, and I missed it. They keep facing 3MB every week, so the competition hasn't exactly been sterling. But they are undefeated. I don't see them getting beaten yet, so I'm going to go with the Matadores. AJ Lee defending the Divas Championship against Brie Bella. Brie Bella has had some halfway decent matches over the last couple of weeks. Dare I say, she looks like she may be improving a little bit. So this could be a good match tonight. You never know. I'm still going to go with AJ, though. I would not take the title off her. I still have no idea what happened with Natalya. They were seemingly building to something with AJ and Natalya, and then they just completely went off course. I had some people write into me saying, well, maybe what they're doing is they're just building the chase. So AJ's going to run through every diva on the roster until she hits that brick wall that is Natalya. If that was the idea, certainly doesn't seem like it anymore. But AJ's my pick to retain the title. Cody Rhodes and Goldust defending the Tag Team Championships in a three-way against The Shield and The Usos. The Usos, I like the Usos a lot, and I really think that they had a chance to put the belts on them earlier, like a few months ago, and they didn't. The Usos may yet end up with the tag belts at some point. I think they will, but way too early to be taking the titles off Cody and Goldust. I like my idea. If the idea is to build to a Cody Goldust match at WrestleMania, and I don't know if it is or not, but if it is, I like the idea that I proposed last week. And so to do that, you've got to keep the belts on these guys for at least a few months. Like I said, through the Rumble would be ideal. Even if it's not the Rumble, though, you got to keep the belts on them for more than just a couple of weeks. So I'm going to go with the Rhodes Brothers, CM Punk against Ryback and Paul Heyman, handicap Hell in a Cell match. There's been a lot of reports online this week about Ryback in the doghouse. Not a lot of fans behind the scenes anymore. They think he's clumsy. They think he's somewhat dangerous to work in the ring with. We saw him almost kill CM Punk all those weeks ago on a press slam outside the ring. I don't know, fact from fiction, what the deal is with Ryback, what's going on there. Apparently the plan now is for Undertaker and Brock Lesnar to have their big showdown at WrestleMania. There were rumors of Undertaker-Ryback. I never bought into that just because, to me, Undertaker-Ryback at WrestleMania has no marquee value at all. I have absolutely no interest in seeing Ryback challenge the streak at WrestleMania. Undertaker-Brock Lesnar, sure. Undertaker-Ryback, no. And I'm not hearing anything about that now. So if that was an idea, that's off the table. So I don't know if that means that Ryback is just going to lose here and they're going to phase him down or what the deal is. He's still with Paul Heyman. I get a kick out of his character, but Ryback himself died a long time ago. I've talked about this over and over on this show. They killed Ryback months and months ago. So whatever they do with him from here on out, to me, it doesn't matter. CM Punk, though, he's got to move out of this feud. He's been feuding now with Heyman and Heyman's army for a few months. I see it going through Survivor Series, and I think after that, you blow it off, you move Punk on to something else. So I don't think this is the end of the Punk Ryback or Punk Heyman feud. I think it goes another month. But still, I'm going to pick CM Punk here. I know that Punk lost to Paul Heyman, okay, at Night of Champions. That's when Ryback debuted as a Paul Heyman guy. Punk beat Ryback earlier this month at Battleground, beat him with a low blow. It would make sense for Ryback to get that win back. For crying out loud, it's a handicap match. Ryback's in there with Paul Heyman as his partner. I know Heyman's not a wrestler, but now you've got a two-on-one scenario. Ryback already lost. He was already made to look like a fool. It would make sense for Ryback to win. My gut still tells me Punk. And if Punk does win, then we know for sure Ryback is doomed. If Ryback can't get a win back over Punk here, we know for sure he's finished. I'm going with CM Punk in this match. Alberto Del Rio and John Cena for the World Heavyweight Championship. John Cena's big comeback. First time in a little over 2 months since SummerSlam that John Cena will be wrestling. He's back from his elbow injury or his triceps tear. Call it whatever you want to. Back from a triceps tear in 2 months. Color me suspicious. But he's back. He is back tonight. And interestingly enough, Damian Sandow has not been featured on TV in weeks. Maybe he's popped up on Main Event or something, and I admit, maybe he popped up even on SmackDown. I haven't been paying as close attention to SmackDown over the last 2 or 3 weeks. I don't think he's been on any of the main shows at all, certainly not Monday Night Raw. He's just vanished after that one SmackDown where they seemingly turned him babyface, and he's really been persona non grata ever since. I think that's by design, and I think that may be because he's cashing in tonight at the pay-per-view. Is he going to cash in successfully? You know what? I'm going to go with John Cena here. John Cena wins the World Heavyweight Championship. There's an outside shot that Sandow will cash in Money in the Bank, and if he does, I say he fails. If he cashes in, I say he fails tonight. I'm still going to go with Cena, though, and they have to, as much as I hate to admit it. Alberto Del Rio is just a complete bust as the champion. He's not a bad wrestler. You know, he's got some pretty good matches under his belt, whether it's with guys like Sheamus or Kofi. He's had a feud before with Cena, although I don't remember it being particularly good, so I would hope tonight's just a one-and-done type of thing. But Del Rio is about as exciting as watching paint dry. There's nothing really appealing about him. They took away one of the more entertaining parts of his act when they broke him up with Ricardo. They took away the cars and everything that was appealing about the guy. It's like Ryback. Ryback was over as a babyface. His music would say, you know, feed me more. He'd come out and do the feed me more. And they stripped that all away when he turned heel, because you have to. If you're going to turn the guy heel, you don't want the fans doing the guy's chant. Made sense. Take it away. But with Ryback, they stripped away everything that was appealing about the guy. So they have a tendency to do this, and Del Rio, to me, is just, he's there. There's nothing appealing. There's nothing exciting about the guy. He's just there. And which is why it boggles my mind they won't put Dolph Ziggler back in the world title picture. They've got the history there with him and Del Rio. Del Rio's the one who beat Ziggler for the championship. You'd think by now, after all these months, they would have done some story where Ziggler has worked his way back up into title contention, and now he's trying to get the belt back. The fans can get behind him. He's been champion before, but still, he's a guy that doesn't exactly have 10 or 12 or 13 world titles like John Cena does under his belt. He's still relatively new in that role as a champion, but they've gone in a different direction here. So I say, let Cena take the title from him. Maybe by having that championship, it will somehow make people care about it again. And then they can go unify the two titles like I suggested in my Layfield column last week, because that World Heavyweight Championship right now is about as useful as tits on a bull. It serves no purpose whatsoever. It is useless. John Cena is my pick. Outside shot, Sandow cashes in. If he does, I say he loses. Main event is Daniel Bryan and Randy Orton for the vacant WWE Championship inside Hell in a Cell with Shawn Michaels as the special guest referee. I'd like to play some audio for you right now. Many of you, I'm sure, have heard this. Many of you have not. Reason being, it never aired on TV, but I want to play a little snippet. I edited pieces of it together. It's not the entire promo. I would highly suggest you go on WWE.com or WWE's YouTube channel and find it. This is a Daniel Bryan promo that they recorded that was intended to promote his Hell in a Cell match against Randy Orton. Never aired this on TV. It aired on .com. I want to play a little bit for you here. Take a listen.
My initial goals when I started wrestling was just to make a living doing what I loved, be the best wrestler I could be. My goals have changed because as you get more success, the better you want to be. I'm mostly known for my technical wrestling, for my submissions, for my kicks, but I'm very comfortable brawling. And the key to my success is being able to adapt everywhere that I've gone. Every time I went to Japan, every time I went to Europe, every time I went to Mexico, there were different styles everywhere I went, and I've had to adapt each and every time. It's a different style here in WWE, and I've been in some brawls, but I see myself as a hybrid, somebody who can do anything. When I started wrestling, you know, I never thought I'd actually be inside of a Hell in a Cell. So now we're days away from it, and I'm getting really excited. If I can beat Randy Orton inside Hell in a Cell, I think this will be the crowning achievement of my career. I always keep my mental focus. That's one of the things that's got me where I am, because people have told me my entire career I couldn't even get to right here. And now here I am, main eventing Hell in a Cell. There's an extreme level of violence to Randy Orton, but he's never seen how violent Daniel Bryan can be. And Randy, at Hell in a Cell, you're going to get your head kicked in. My name is Daniel Bryan, and I'm a professional wrestler.
How great was that promo right there? How great was that to, in terms of building up the Hell in a Cell match tonight? They did a better job in that one video of getting me amped up for this Hell in a Cell match at the pay-per-view than anything they've done on Raw over the last 2 or 3 weeks. And it doesn't really even do the video justice just listening to it here, because he also talks about the very first Hell in a Cell match between Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker. They have highlights from that match. He talks about what a brutal, hardcore match that was and what a beating those guys took and the blood and everything else. And they really sold me on how important this match is to Daniel Bryan, how he's going into his first Hell in a Cell match tonight. He's going to lay it all on the line. We're going to see things that we've never seen from him before. And they just did a tremendous job with this 1 3-minute video, and yet they couldn't find 3 minutes for this on a 3-hour show. It boggles my mind. I don't understand it. They had a great video on Raw Monday night talking about the relationship between Daniel Bryan and Shawn Michaels that I thought was also very good. And they had some rare footage in there that they've never aired on Raw before from Shawn Michaels' old Texas Wrestling Academy back in 1999-2000, when Bryan Danielson, among others, including Spanky and I think Lance Caden and some other guys, were part of that training class. And Shawn Michaels helped train. I mean, I think it was more Rudy Boy Gonzalez and later on William Regal who really trained Daniel Bryan. But Bryan gives Shawn Michaels a lot of credit for giving him advice. And it was Shawn's promotion. You heard Shawn on commentary calling one of Brian's earliest matches. That video also was really, really cool. But that video served a different purpose. That video served the purpose of establishing a relationship between Shawn Michaels and Daniel Bryan. It's one thing to have Shawn Michaels come out and say, oh, I trained this young man. It's another thing to actually show us footage of them from 13 years ago to prove it. And you hear Shawn Michaels on commentary 13, 14 years ago talking about, wow, this guy's going to be really good. Watch this kid. He's going to be something. That's pretty cool stuff. This video here, the audio that you just heard, this video is what should have aired on Raw Monday night. Just get rid of that whole bullshit contract signing segment at the end of the show that served no purpose but to massage Triple H's ego and air this video instead. And do one for Randy Orton, too. I don't know that it would be as interesting. I think part of the appeal and the interest in Brian's background is him talking about working in different places around the world, like Mexico and Japan and all over the place, and all the different styles and, you know, footage of him wrestling these indie matches, showing how he's worked up to where he is today. Randy Orton doesn't have that kind of background. Randy Orton really just went to OVW many years ago. He got his foot in the door because of who his father was, and they trained him there, and he's pretty much been in WWE for his entire career. But it just boggles my mind. Why is this video not on Raw Monday night? This is the sort of thing. It had a very UFC countdown type vibe to me. And the countdown shows that UFC does exist for one purpose. It's to get people interested in buying whatever that pay-per-view is. Right? Whatever that main fight is, it's to get people amped up for it. So they'll pay their money. They'll pay their $50 or whatever it is to see those two guys fight and beat the hell out of each other. That was, I thought, what this video accomplished. And they couldn't even find 3 minutes to air it on Raw Monday night. Just completely ridiculous. Who's going to win this match? Daniel Bryan, to me, has to win this match. He has to. I mean, I'm not saying he definitely will. I could see them doing some sort of swerve. Wouldn't count that out as a possibility. But everything is set up perfectly for Bryan to finally win the big one and hold on to it. No screw job finish. No stripping him of the championship on Raw the next night in Orlando or anything like that. He goes into the cell. They have a great match because we know these two guys can have a great match. You give these guys 20, 25 minutes, they're going to have an awesome match. It's going to be hard for them not to. All people remember from the end of Battleground earlier this month was the stupid bullshit finish. They've done everything they can to guarantee you that that will not happen again. There will be no bullshit finish. There is guaranteed. Remember last time I said they never used that word on TV, guaranteed, so they couldn't, you know, people couldn't complain, hey, we didn't get a new champion. Well, this time they have used that word. They're guaranteeing that when this pay-per-view is over, we will have a new WWE champion. So in that respect, they've done a good job of at least telling you, okay, this time you can really believe us. Take our word for it. We promise we're not going to give you a silly finish like we did earlier this month. Shawn Michaels is in there. He promises to call it down the middle. There's going to be a winner. He's the authority in that match. In theory, these guys are surrounded by a cage that's meant to keep people out, whether it's Big Show or The Shield or whoever it may be. Watch that Big Show. I don't entirely trust that guy. Not that I need to see another Big Show heel turn, but he's almost been too chummy with Daniel Bryan over the last few weeks, doing his yes chant and everything. It almost just screams heel turn. I'm going with Daniel Bryan. He's got to win here. He loses this match, and I don't know. I mean, he'll be okay, I guess, but it's not going to do the Daniel Bryan character any favors to fall short yet again, get screwed over yet again. He's got to win. He's got to win decisively. We need that last image of him inside the cage or on top of the cage, standing there with the championship, Shawn Michaels raising his arm. It's got to be a legitimate victory, no doubt about it, no referee fast count, no BS, no interference. And I'm pulling for him because the character has been dragged through the mud over these last couple of months. Yes, he is main eventing his fourth pay-per-view in a row. That's true. But he's got to win the championship here, and I'm going with Daniel Bryan for that reason. And to go back to the Del Rio-John Cena thing real quick here, if I can, for a second, because I left this out. I wanted to mention this. Jim Ross has been a little more prickly, shall we say, in some of his recent blog posts. You could tell the guy is free. Whatever arrangement he worked out with WWE, severance or whatever, he is free and clear. He's speaking his mind now. And he had this interesting little nugget from his most recent blog. And this is concerning the Del Rio-Cena match at the pay-per-view. He says, "The returning John Cena world title bout versus champion Alberto Del Rio feels a touch lost in the shuffle, perhaps because it was made essentially out of nowhere, or perhaps Del Rio has little momentum, or because Cena is returning early from his surgery and he doesn't feel as if he's been gone that long to make his return even more special." That's from Jim Ross. That's exactly what I've been saying. That's exactly what everybody's been saying. The match came out of nowhere. No rhyme or reason, just, hey, John Cena's back, he's wrestling for the world title. And here he is talking about how Del Rio has no momentum. Which is just what I was talking about a few minutes ago. Del Rio is just a guy. He's just there. He's got no momentum. And Cena is coming back early from surgery where even if he's able to, and everything's on the up and up, and it's great news, I'm all healed up, I'm ready to get back in the game, and I'm sure in terms of, you know, house shows and merchandise and stuff like that, WWE is ecstatic to get John Cena back early. But he was never gone long enough to make people really care that much. It's like, oh, John Cena's back. Well, he's only been gone for 2 months. Whereas if he came back in the Rumble, and I'm not even saying as a surprise, you can do videos on TV to build up John Cena coming back at the Royal Rumble if you want to, and maybe throw Sheamus in there as a surprise. I mean, do whatever you want. But if Cena were gone 4 or 5 months, that would probably mean more. I mean, the people who hate the guy are going to still hate him. You know, you're never going to change their minds. But for everybody else, I think it would mean more. It would be more special. I agree 100% with what Jim Ross said. In that one little paragraph, he nailed every single reason that this match just feels completely out of place. Monday Night Raw this past week was live from the King's hometown of Memphis, Tennessee. Go through the good, the bad, and the ugly here. Some random Raw observations. Show actually opened up with a hell of a match, I thought. A really fun match between Daniel Bryan and Dean Ambrose. This was maybe the longest Dean Ambrose match I've seen, maybe ever. And Ambrose taps clean to the S-lock. Not a big fan of all of these losses. The Shield is just racking up every single week. They went unbeaten for so many months, and all of a sudden they're losing every single match, as I think they will at Hell in a Cell tonight. But I suppose one must pay it forward after so many victories. You can't win every match forever. So that was a fun match. Another thing I noted here as I was going along watching the show Monday, they must have been talking about Randy Orton and his 10 world titles. And the thought struck me, you know, I remember when title reigns meant something and you could actually remember each one. I could still sit here and go through pretty much every single WWE champion from not even the 80s, but pretty much the entire decade of the 90s and the early part of the 2000s. I think at some point, maybe in the mid-2000s, like the middle of the most recent decade, is where things started to get a little foggy for me, and I wonder if other people feel the same way. I couldn't even tell you now when it comes to Cena and Orton and all of these guys, Del Rio. Oh, when did they win their first title? Or maybe I remember the first one, but what about their second or their third or their fourth? I couldn't even tell you. I'd probably get my dates jumbled and everything else, but yet I can go back 15 years, 20 years, and recite the exact event, the exact time, and it's just, it really is, it's something to see when you really stop and look at it. Orton's won 10 world titles, and I can't remember half of them. And I think that's part of the problem, is that these days, people are just winning so many championships. Everybody is a 10-time. Randy Orton's a 10-time champion. John Cena's a 10-time champion. Edge was an 11-time champion. These titles are like Pez. I mean, everybody, you just spit them out like a Pez dispenser, and everybody can have 10 titles, and it just doesn't mean anything. So, anyway, that thought struck me when they were talking about Orton's 10 titles, and I can only remember half of them. I can't even remember where the other half came from. The Shield had a match on this show with the Usos. And my first thought was, the Shield lost the tag team titles to Cody and Goldust, never got a rematch. Why do they have to fight to get a rematch at Hell in a Cell? And then many of you on Twitter pointed out that the Usos were actually technically the number one contenders. I guess Cody and Goldust snuck ahead of them in line. They're still the number one contenders, so they put the Shield against them to figure out who it would be. Pretty much when they made that match, I knew it was going to be some kind of schmoz. I figured they were going to do a three-way or turn it into a fatal four-way or something, and that's what they did. We got no outcome, but the Shield and the Usos had another really good match. I still maintain one of my favorite matches of the year, probably when this year is over, it's going to be way up there on my list, is that Money in the Bank kickoff match, the pre-show match for the tag titles with the Shield defending against the Usos. I was in Philadelphia for that match. It was awesome. These two teams work very well together. They have great chemistry. And technically, they were the main event on this show. The main event segment was a contract signing. The main event match was the Shield and the Usos. So even though we got a bullshit non-finish, it was still a very good match. Although, I do have to say, I thought the commentary for that match, the Shield against the Usos, was horrendous. Absolutely horrendous. They had Cody and Goldust were out there on commentary, so you had them with JBL, with Lawler, with Cole. JBL probably had Vince in his ear. He was going on another commentary rampage. The thing about JBL is, as entertaining as he can be so overwhelming. He just overwhelms everything, overwhelms everybody on headset. And in this case, it did not work. Sometimes it can be entertaining. This was not one of those times. I thought the commentary was just atrocious. It took away from the match. The match was still very good, but it was almost, I won't say ruined. Ruined is too strong of a word, but the commentary did not help this match at all. So I just wanted to point that out. I thought it was actually a huge detriment during this match. I mentioned earlier the Daniel Bryan, Shawn Michaels video package that they aired on this show. I thought this was great stuff. And to me, if it proves one thing, I know it's his character, I know he's not going to, but it's time for Daniel Bryan, I think, to get a shave and a haircut. He looks, I don't know, I mean, he looks like a 12-year-old boy without all the facial hair, but I think he looks better that way. I think he looks less unkempt, but it's his character, it's who he is now, I guess he's got no choice, it would kill the gimmick. It's funny to me because when he used to look that way without all the facial hair and everything, I would go to these Ring of Honor shows at the Manhattan Center here in New York, and without fail, every single time, I would show up at the ROH show, I would get in, and as I'm about to go, you know, find my seats, they have these security guys, I guess that work for Ring of Honor, they're just standing there, and they take one look at me and they go, oh, look, it's the Bryan Danielson guy. Because for some reason they had it in their head that I looked exactly like Bryan Danielson. I saw very little similarity, but apparently they all thought that I did, and they would mock me every single time they would see me. It got to the point where I was the Bryan Danielson guy. That was basically their name for me. Hey, what can I say? It's a good look. These days, Bryan looks like a wildebeest. That would not be a good look for me. CM Punk and Big E Langston took on Ryback and Curtis Axel on this show. Big E finished off Axel with the big ending to promote the fact that he's got a pretty good shot of taking the Intercontinental title off Axel at the kickoff show tonight, if it is in fact still happening. Like I said, when I checked before, the match was no longer listed on the website. It could have just been an oversight, or maybe plans changed. I guess we'll find out. Nothing much to it. I mean, it was a good match. Big E came out of this looking pretty good, and he got to celebrate with Punk in the end. Really, nothing else of any great note happened on the show Monday until the main event segment, so we may as well skip to that. That's what a lot of people were talking about this week. The contract signing for the Hell in a Cell Championship match. Daniel Bryan, Randy Orton, Shawn Michaels was out there with them, as was Triple H and Stephanie. I believe Stephanie was out there. Triple H. This was the Triple H show here. Triple H was on the microphone. And by the way, Triple H in his most fitting role on this show. That of introducing Shawn Michaels. That's one of the things that Triple H will go down as being most well known for. Is Shawn Michaels' sidekick. So it was quite appropriate that he would be on the show introducing Shawn Michaels. So he's out there, he's doing a promo, and he says that he has seen guys like Daniel Bryan come and go a million times. He compared him to Chris Jericho, Edge, and Rob Van Dam, in that all of them are talented, all of them are popular, but they were never the one. And I thought that line was priceless, considering Triple H himself was never the one. Remember, he's the guy who works with the guy who draws money. Thank you, Jim Cornette. That's a great line. Triple H said that if any of those guys had been the face of WWE back in the day, they would all be working for Ted Turner right now, which is not exactly factually true. Ted Turner was already long gone there by the end. But I understand the point he was trying to make. My question is this. Why even bother having Triple H in this promo bring these guys up? Edge can't even wrestle anymore. This is the second time now that Edge has been dragged into this angle, and Triple H has made comments about him having never drawn money and all this nonsense. Who cares? Who cares? We get it. The Triple H character is a dick. All this does is tell people that when you win the world title 11 times like Edge did, plus now he's in the Hall of Fame, which makes it even worse, it doesn't mean a thing. You're still not a top guy, even with all that stuff, even with all those credentials, you're still not considered a top guy. Boy, that doesn't speak too well to their world titles now, does it? To his credit, Edge went on Twitter, he said, look, it's entertainment, no need to get all worked up about it. He's right, of course. Funny thing is, of the three guys that Triple H mentioned, Edge is the one who you can say really did draw money. He carried an entire brand. He never carried the whole company, but he was SmackDown. He was SmackDown there for several years. Chris Jericho on Twitter, he reacted to Triple H's comments by saying, "Time to move on, guys. Bye-bye, WWE. Now time for more important things." Right. See you in a few months, Chris. In the meantime, Jericho has a new web series called But I'm Chris Jericho, which debuts this Tuesday. He plays a version of himself as an ex-wrestler trying to make it as an actor. I saw the trailer. It actually looks pretty funny. So, again, that premieres online this Tuesday. This whole segment was basically Triple H ragging on Daniel Bryan and Bryan reacting to Triple H. Then Shawn Michaels talks to Triple H. "What's going on with you? This is not the Triple H I know that would play strip poker and ride the tank into WCW and all that stuff." Randy Orton spoke up at one point, and I seriously had almost forgotten he was even out there. Triple H did the same spiel about Bryan being inferior. "You're a B+, you're too small, you're not a star." The same rant he goes on every single week. And you know, you tell people something long enough, they start to believe it. And then they wonder why they can't make any new stars. Just imagine. Imagine if when Bret Hart or Steve Austin were getting over in WWE, they had Bruno Sammartino and Billy Graham, right? The two of the bigger stars from the most recent generation out there on TV, taking up half their TV time and talking about how inferior they are and how much smaller and less muscular they are as compared to the wrestlers from their generation. I'm wondering when this shift happened. I know it's only the last decade or so, but I'd love to know exactly when. When did this start to happen? This trend in wrestling, or in WWE at least, where you beat your own guys down like this verbally on TV over and over and over again. I would love to know exactly when this trend started and with who. Bryan will have headlined four straight pay-per-views after this weekend. I mentioned that earlier. He's won the WWE Championship twice, albeit for very brief periods of time, but still, he's now a two-time champion. Why would Triple H be out there saying that Bryan isn't a star? Doesn't even make any storyline sense. At least they had Shawn Michaels out there to stick up for the guy. The only way you could justify this whole thing, to me, is if it pays off with Triple H against Daniel Bryan, with Bryan winning. Cleanly and decisively beating Triple H either with the knee or making him tap out to the S-lock. That's the only way. That's it. Bryan actually did challenge Triple H to a match. Triple H mocked him for even the mere suggestion that he might wrestle Daniel Bryan. He said, "You know, you're beneath me. You're not The Undertaker. You're not Brock Lesnar. You're not The Rock. Why would I fight you?" That's great. That's really great. Daniel Bryan was at Ringside Fest here in New York City this weekend doing a signing. And Mike Johnson of PWInsider.com actually nabbed an interview about 4 or 5 minutes long. On their PW Insider TV deal that they have on their YouTube channel. You can look it up. PW Insider TV, I think, is the YouTube username. And he interviewed Bryan, and he actually asked Bryan at one point, point blank, "What's your reaction to the criticism?" A lot of fans are very riled up about the storyline, but not in that the storyline is working like, "Oh, you know, Triple H is such a bad guy, we're behind Daniel Bryan." They're riled up in that they feel the storyline isn't doing your character any favors. And they're levying a lot of criticism towards WWE. How do you feel about this? Now, in any other interview, you would expect Bryan or anybody else doing an interview, right, for WWE, that they would say, "Oh, you know, they just have to let the story play out. It's the internet, blah, blah, blah." Not Daniel Bryan. I thought his response was very telling. His response to Mike Johnson in this interview essentially was, "Good. It's good to have constructive criticism. If that's how they really feel, you've got to let the company know." So in other words, you know, again, constructive. Don't just say it sucks. Like when I do my show every week, I'm talking about it now. You don't see me here on the Sound Off saying, "This sucks," and then moving on. If I say something sucks, normally I'll follow it up with a suggestion on why it sucks or what they could be doing to fix that. That's called constructive criticism. And that's what he's saying here. It's good to have criticism. Don't just say it sucks, but say it sucks, and here's why. Here's what to do or here's what you should be doing differently, or shouldn't be doing at all. And he basically said, good, I welcome it, I think it's great. I wonder how he really feels about this whole thing. I'm sure he's very happy, he's getting the biggest push of his life. Couldn't happen to a nicer guy. But I feel like he's gotten over in spite of the company's efforts. Yes, they've put him in the pay-per-view main event, in part because John Cena got hurt and he's not around. But he was already well over with the audience before all of this happened. In fact, the reason they took notice and put him in these main events was because of the reactions he was already getting. He didn't need much of a bigger push. You know what I mean? He was out there doing it all on his own. Just like Punk 2 years ago. Punk got himself over. And then Triple H inserted himself into the feud, and Punk was less over by the time it was over. And I fear we're kind of seeing the same thing here. And I think that's a bad thing. And I wonder how he really feels about that. So that's not even the end of the segment here. Then we have Stone Cold Paul White rolling into the arena in a semi. For what reason? Beats me. I love how last weekend on Sound Off 297, I compared WWE's booking of Big Show to Steve Austin. And then on this show, he drives a truck into the arena. The only thing missing was the beer hose, but it's PG, so I guess you can't do that. Big Show is positioned here. You'd think he's the top babyface in the company. He is the top babyface in the company based on this booking here. Yet he's not the one wrestling for the title at the pay-per-view. I guess, like I said, he could always do a heel turn, screw over Brian. I'd keep an eye on him. Not really hard to do since he's a giant and all. But Big Show now has been the dominant face at the end of Raw 3 weeks in a row. It doesn't have a match on the show. Obviously, they're doing the storyline. Apparently, Vince McMahon is on his way back. He may be back on TV as early as Raw this Monday night in Orlando. He'll be tied into this storyline somehow. Wouldn't surprise me at all if we finally find out that Vince McMahon is the one pulling the strings, helping to get Big Show back on TV, helping to get him his job back, and this starts whatever this storyline twist is that they have planned, where Vince will end up as the babyface, Triple H, of course, is the heel. They squabble for control of the company, and maybe it culminates in some match at WrestleMania where Vince picks somebody to wrestle Triple H. I know they wanted Steve Austin. I doubt that's going to happen. I would not mind it being The Rock. If they've moved on from this idea of Brock Lesnar and The Rock at WrestleMania next year, and at one point the idea had been that The Rock would make an appearance in Miami at the Hell in a Cell pay-per-view tonight to shoot some sort of angle that would start the storyline with him and Brock. Maybe Lesnar would attack him and lay him out or something. Doubt very seriously we're going to be seeing The Rock on the show tonight. So if they've moved on from that, and Lesnar is occupied, and Rock ends up deciding, you know what, I can do WrestleMania, I would like to do the show, I'm one of those people that would not mind seeing a Rock Triple H match for old time's sake. They had one of the better feuds and the more memorable feuds during the Attitude Era in WWE history. They had, at least all those years ago, they had great chemistry. They haven't had a match since 2002. They're a lot older now, so who knows. As long as they're not headlining WrestleMania, I have no problem at all if they wanted to go in that direction. But who knows if The Rock is even going to work that show. Maybe they save the Daniel Bryan Triple H match for WrestleMania with Bryan going over in the end. Vince comes to his senses, or Big Show, you know, convinces Vince, you know, you were wrong about Daniel Bryan. You got to put your faith and trust in this guy. And Vince does the unthinkable and has Daniel Bryan as his surrogate with the company hanging in the balance. That'd be quite the way to put Daniel Bryan over in the end. If Vince admits he was wrong, I have full faith and trust in you. The company hangs in the balance. And in the end, he ends up beating Triple H in one of the main matches at WrestleMania. Like I said, that right there could be justification to some degree for all this bullshit they've been saying about Bryan and doing with him. I have no idea if that's the idea. Would not be the worst idea in the world. So we'll see what they do. But Vince is supposed to be back on TV this week, so we're going to get a sense of it, what direction they're going in very quickly. One last WWE note here. This makes me very sad. This was originally reported in the Wrestling Observer newsletter, and it's upset a lot of people in the Twitter sphere, I noticed. It's concerning Yoshitatsu. Yes, Yoshitatsu is in fact still employed by WWE. You would never know it, although I guess he was in that skit with Ryback a month or two ago. That was the last time I think we saw Yoshi on any of the main shows. Apparently, Yoshitatsu asked The Office if he could move from Florida. He's been living in Florida, you know, at the Performance Center, developmental, all that stuff, so he's very close by. Apparently, he found a community of Japanese people who live in Texas, and he really wanted to move there. And Sho Funaki, who was with WWE for years and years and years, how he kept his job for so long, I'll never know. I know that he lives, or at one point lived in Texas. Maybe there is a community of Japanese down there I'm not aware of. I know he actually is very good friends with Steve Austin. I don't know if they were neighbors or anything like that, but I always laughed when I would read that Funaki and Austin were such good friends. So apparently there is a community of people there he wanted to move, and WWE said, no, you are not allowed to move. We want you to stay in Florida. You need to be at practice every single day at the Performance Center so you can become a better worker. Now think about that. Yoshitatsu was such a horrible wrestler, and he's been with the company for so many years now. You're still such a shitty wrestler. We're not going to let you move to Texas where you'd be more comfortable with other Japanese folks. You have to stay in Florida because you're so damn horrible. We need you to do your practice drills like a rookie every single day. This guy came from New Japan Pro Wrestling, okay? He's not a young guy either. He's in his mid-30s. He's been with WWE for a number of years. They never did jack shit with him. He's actually a very good wrestler. If they would open their frickin' eyes and actually look at this guy and look at some of the matches he's had on some of those lower shows, they never give him a chance because he's Japanese, right? I guess he's got slanty eyes. And so in WWE's face, oh, yo, he should come to the ring with a bowl of rice and we'll give him some chopsticks and we'll give him some cymbals, his theme music. Ha, ha, ha. Fuck you. I mean, that's how they treat these guys. He never had a shot. And you read something like that, and it's like, really? Just quit. If I'm Yoshitatsu, I don't know what his financial situation is, but I'd look these guys in the face and say, fuck you, I quit. And you know what? He'd probably get some pretty decent work on the independent circuit. He can move wherever he wants to at that point. Maybe even go back to Japan, New Japan. I'm sure he could find work there. He's a good worker. He's a good wrestler. Just completely ridiculous to me. I know they have guys on their days off who go in there to train and try to improve and get better. And that's fine if you've got these newer guys or girls or whoever. This guy's been around the block. He's not a rookie. He's not a new guy. Not even in terms of just his age, in terms of how long he's been in this company for. You would think if Yoshitatsu was so horrible, they'd let him go. But he's not horrible. So you read something like that, and it makes you sad for the guy. I don't follow him on Twitter. I will check his Twitter page out every now and then. He just comes off as the nicest guy in the world. He's learning English. He's always posting tweets like he's getting ready for bed. Have a good night, everybody, and what a beautiful day outside and stuff. He just comes off as the nicest guy in the world, and you read something like that, and it just makes you shake your head. I wonder if he's really even comfortable where he is right now down there in Florida, if he wants to move away so bad. It's such a sad thing to me. And here's a guy who gave up what was a pretty good career at the time over in Japan, and probably gave up a lot of money, too, to come to WWE all those years ago. He's kind of got an interesting story that a lot of people may not realize, so I would never question his passion to want to be a wrestler and all that. It's just really upsetting, I think, to read something like that. We'll skip NXT this week, get back to it on the next episode. I want to move on now to Impact Wrestling. TNA had its WrestleMania last weekend, Bound for Glory 2013 at the Viejas Arena in San Diego, California, reportedly in the range of about 2,500 to maybe 3,000 people in the building. By all accounts, the people who were there in the building had a great time. One of our listeners, Troy, attended Bound for Glory. He had this to say, "I've been fortunate to attend back-to-back Bound for Glories, and this year's was complete awesomeness. As most of the pictures online have shown, there was a lot of empty room at the show, but that did not stop the crowd from being vocal at all. It was loud and passionate, didn't need a full arena to give off a full arena vibe. Even the matches you think would suck, the tag title match, the knockouts, received a TNA chant or chants of "This is awesome." All of the wrestlers seemed inspired to give the crowd a show they could be proud of, a sort of rebirth for TNA, to think that finally all the champions are young and products of TNA. So that comes from Troy. He had a good time. "I called Bobby Roode, Chris Sabin, and Magnus winning. All my other picks, unfortunately, were incorrect. But I was right on those three. I predicted Bully would retain the championship, figuring they were planning some kind of patented TNA swerve, as they've done in the past. But lo and behold, there was no swerve. AJ Styles won the championship, as had been planned all along. And I say good. Good on them for sticking with the plan and not feeling the need to shock everybody just for the sake of shocking everybody. And for the record, I think AJ and Bully actually had a very good match at the pay-per-view. Their match on Impact this week, the rematch, was not nearly as good. In fact, it wasn't really that good at all. But the match on the pay-per-view, I got into it. Bully laid in those chops, and AJ took all of it, and you looked at his chest. His chest was already bruised up, broken blood vessels. It can't be fun to take those kinds of chops. So Bully was stiffing him. He was laying it in there. Basically, you know, you're going to beat me for the championship. You're going to feel it. And there was a spot during the main event match, probably the spot of the entire pay-per-view, where AJ did a springboard 450 from the inside of the ring, off the top rope, through a table outside the ring. Bully moved, and AJ, when I say AJ crashed through the table, this goes beyond a normal table spot where the table just breaks. The table exploded. It was like there was a device rigged underneath it that went off at the precise moment that AJ went through it, and it just exploded. It was a great visual. It looked like he killed himself. I mean, it was just like, this guy is killing himself for this company right now. I don't know why he is. It's puzzling to me why he would do that to himself for TNA, but he did. And from there, he ended up winning with the spiral tap in the end. They did the same deal where Bully started cutting up parts of the ring to expose the wood, the plywood underneath. There were some aces and eights, bozos, who came down to interfere, but then they just left inexplicably. They never came back. And this was a no disqualification match where the owner of the company did not want AJ to win. So essentially, Bully had the full support and blessing of Dixie Carter. No DQ. Why the aces and eights guys would leave and not come back, that was never explained. But that's what happened. But I think it made for a better match. No BS, no games. AJ wins. He runs into the crowd to celebrate. This was a lot better than a few weeks before this on Impact when AJ ran into the crowd and there were like eight people who mobbed him and it looked kind of sad. Here, it was a great visual. Everybody mobbed him. He had the championship raised up in the air. It was a good moment at the end of the show for TNA, I think. It was a good moment. All of the titles changed hands on this show. And they're clearly making some attempt at getting over younger talent. There was no Hulk Hogan to be found. Sting put over Magnus about as cleanly as I've ever seen him put over anybody in TNA or in WCW. Kurt Angle lost to Bobby Roode, although the finish was a bit of a clusterfuck. But still, Bobby Roode beat Kurt Angle. They put the tag team titles on the frickin' Bromans, which I was completely wrong about last week. I didn't think there was a shot in hell of them doing that. But they did. They put the tag team titles on the Jersey Shore guys. And they debuted Ethan Carter III as Dixie's nephew. So at least he's a new face. The old Derek Bateman from NXT portraying Dixie's nephew on TV. He's got a ways to go. He had a match on Impact on Thursday. He had a job match, as he did here on the pay-per-view. Didn't really show much. I see some people, oh, he stole Dean Ambrose's headlock DDT move. Actually, it's the other way around. I was not aware of this, I admit. I didn't follow NXT as closely back in the day. But apparently that move is a move that Bateman was using back in his NXT days. So in effect, Dean Ambrose stole the move from him. So just to get your facts straight there. But they're making an attempt here, okay, with the younger guys and all that jazz. And at least for that reason, if nothing else, I think TNA should at least be commended. They seem to be making some sort of effort in that direction. Sting. I mentioned Sting a moment ago. Sting had a match with Magnus. He put him over. It was not a good match. Sting is unable, I'm guessing, to bend his knees much anymore. When he does the Scorpion Deathlock, it looks terrible. I used to joke about how awful The Rock was when he would try the sharpshooter. And the thing with The Rock also is, he's like John Cena. When John Cena puts somebody in the STF, it's just like when The Rock would do the sharpshooter. Both of those guys would have these pained expressions on their faces, like they were in more pain than their opponent, who they were putting the move on. But The Rock would stand up. The Rock would cross the guy's legs for the sharpshooter, would barely sit back. He'd basically be standing. And it was like, why even do the move? Don't do that move, please. Even Bret Hart was mocking The Rock at different points on Twitter and stuff whenever he would do the sharpshooter. Sting now, who was using the move years before Bret Hart was. Okay, he didn't invent the move, but he made it popular. And I hate to say it, but I'm thinking that if Sting is going to insist on wrestling for a while longer, he probably should no longer do the Scorpion Deathlock if he can't bend his knees. I mean, he's 55 years old. He probably has bad knees. I get it. I get it if he can't bend them the way that he used to. But if that's the case, it just looks terrible. And the good thing for Sting is he's got other moves. He's got the Scorpion Death Drop. So I say ditch the Deathlock if you can't do it the right way anymore because it just looks sad. And use the Scorpion Death Drop. It's a very straightforward move. You hook the guy's head, you ram him down into the mat. It's more devastating. Just stick with that. I don't really have a lot of other notes on this show, to be honest with you. I thought everything else was okay. In some cases, it was very good. I thought Ultimate X just was good. It was kind of underwhelming, to be perfectly honest with you. Although I was happy, as predicted, to see Sabin walk away with the championship. I am a fan of his new heel persona. There was nothing else that jumped out at me. Bad Influence continues to be booked poorly in this company. They're very entertaining when they're out there and they do those skits, but they're so much better than that. And yet they couldn't even get out of the gauntlet match. It's not even like they won the gauntlet but then lost to James Storm and Gunner. They were like the first ones, I think, right? They were the first ones eliminated in the gauntlet. It was just pathetic to me. What was also pathetic, although I guess it's part of a storyline, but it just makes you go, LOL, TNA. Kurt Angle on this show rejected. He declined his Hall of Fame induction. Sting was in the ring, and this was a little bizarre to me because they had a Hall of Fame dinner. They actually had a Hall of Fame banquet on Saturday, and there were some speeches made. Again, Kurt did a speech, very brief speech, 5 minutes. People were disappointed. And yet, he comes out on the pay-per-view. I guess that was the actual induction. I was completely confused by that. And he actually declined. He said, thanks, but no thanks. I don't want to be in the TNA Hall of Fame. And it's part of the storyline they're doing where he doesn't feel he's worthy of it. He's let a lot of people down. I don't think he mentioned the rehab, but that's kind of what he was getting at. And they're doing this redemption storyline with him, I guess, where he's going to have to work his way back up. Maybe a year from now, Bound for Glory, he'll be wrestling for the championship. I would hope not. I think the days of Kurt Angle as champion have passed. But maybe in a year he'll accept his Hall of Fame induction. If TNA is going to do a Hall of Fame, especially now that nobody went in this year, they've got to start putting two or three guys in. There's no reason Jeff Jarrett shouldn't be in the TNA Hall of Fame. Don West, who isn't even with the company anymore, and I know it sounds ridiculous, but Don West was a very key part of that company in terms of merchandising, and then he did other things for them too. He was an announcer, he was a manager for a cup of coffee, and then Eric Bischoff, I guess, wasn't a fan of Don West as a manager when he was managing Amazing Red, and they put the Ixnay on that. One of those very bright decisions Eric Bischoff, I think, was responsible for. I thought Don West, for the limited time he was a manager, was quite great. He could have been a great manager. But the point is, TNA has had a lot of instrumental people in their history who deserve to be recognized, and I think they ought to start putting some more people in there. But anyway, that's part of the storyline they're doing with Kurt Angle. He did lose to Bobby Roode on this show. Not really much else to say about it. Eric Bischoff and TNA, that's the bigger story. Eric Bischoff was not backstage at Bound for Glory or the Impact taping on Thursday. They had a talent meeting in the afternoon before the taping on Thursday, and the talent were told that going forward, Bischoff would be working for the company from home. And to me, that is a fancy way of saying he's gone, or at least he will be shortly. Nobody seemed to know for sure. The impression most people got was Bischoff, if he isn't done, is just about done. That's their way of saying that. Bischoff, as vocal as he sometimes is on his Twitter page, loves to knock down bullshit internet rumors, all these nerds on the internet, they don't know what they're talking about, the dirt sheets, all this crap. He has not said word one about any of this, and I think his silence is very telling. Looks to me like Bischoff and TNA are done. They're Splitsville. And that's telling to me because I really thought Hulk Hogan was coming back to TNA. I thought through all the teasing that he might show up at WrestleMania 30, he's on his Twitter, what should I do, brother? Should I stay with TNA or go back to WWE? That in the end, he would stay with TNA. He'd get a sweet money deal. He'd come back. And maybe he still will. It's not like him and Eric Bischoff are Siamese twins attached at the hip. Hogan could very well still end up in TNA at some point. But if Bischoff is gone, or if Bischoff's power is severely reduced, that really tells me that there's a very real possibility that Hogan may not be back. Which just makes it even worse, the way they, you know, filmed that last scene with Dixie Carter hugging his leg. They can scream creative control all they want to. I still blame TNA for even putting themselves in that position in the first place. But if Bischoff and Hogan are truly gone, it's the best news that TNA could possibly get. Okay? I say good riddance if Eric Bischoff is gone. And yes, he has been a positive in certain areas. Eric Bischoff is very good at what he does on the production side of things. He's got a production company that he runs with his buddy Jason Hervey, okay, the guy from the Wonder Years. They've done that for a number of years, and they've been very successful. They've got a lot of television shows that are in development, that have made it to television, different networks, all different kinds of shows. Okay, he's very good at that. He's moved on. He's branched out. And in TNA, I will give him credit for this. I assume he's the one who deserves credit for this. About 2 or 3 years ago, TNA had this little thing called TNA Reaction, which was essentially an Impact post show where they would... It was completely in character, kayfabe, it wasn't out of character. But it was after the show, backstage, filming the wrestlers, different interviews about what just happened, and a way of advancing storylines, but it was filmed in this gritty, realistic kind of way. I actually liked it. And, you know, Reaction was on at a time when I was not following Impact in full week to week. I would see clips and, you know, bits of Impact. I couldn't stomach watching an entire show, okay? I didn't start watching Impact again in full until May of last year, and I've stuck with it. Reaction, I think, goes back to like 2010 or something like that. But that was one of those things TNA was doing that I looked at, and I said, this is cool. This is something I wish WWE would do. So if that was a Bischoff idea, I give him a lot of credit for it. And I was sad when they canceled Reaction. It didn't last very long. But aside from that, name one good thing Eric Bischoff has done for TNA. Name one positive to Eric Bischoff being in any sort of position of power in TNA. It's the same thing I asked last week and 2 weeks ago when it came to Hulk Hogan. Name me one really, truly positive thing, hindsight being 2020, that Hulk Hogan meant to TNA. Did he open the door for some international TV deals for them? I don't know. Maybe he did. They were signing international TV deals before Hogan ever came aboard. So if TNA all of a sudden has television in Romania, I'm not going to sit here and say, oh, that's all due to Hulk Hogan. Maybe it was, maybe it wasn't. Name me one really positive thing either one of those guys did for TNA. TNA ratings, TNA business overall is lower. It's lower now than when those two guys came in January of 2010, I think, is when they debuted on TV. Technically, they signed at the end of 2009, okay? Most, if not all, business indicators for TNA that we're aware of, the TV ratings, the house shows, everything, business in general, is lower. Lower. So, good riddance, is what I say, as far as that goes. They need a fresh start. I don't know who takes Bischoff's place, because Bischoff was handling creative stuff, I guess, ever since Bruce Pritchard said goodbye. So I don't know who they put in his place. I don't know if Jeff Jarrett regains more power in the company, if they bring somebody else in from the outside, if they bring a non-wrestling person in from the outside. Maybe it works. Maybe it's an even bigger disaster. But they got to try something, because what they were doing before wasn't working. And at the same meeting on Thursday afternoon, the wrestlers were informed that their run of road tapings for Impact is coming to an end after their taping in Cincinnati on November 7th, that will be the final, for now, the final road taping. They will still tape Impact on the road here and there in the future, but the consistent every other week road tapings are a thing of the past. They will have tapings in Orlando November 21 through November 23rd. They're going to tape about 4 to 6 weeks worth of shows. They'll be back, I think, at Universal Studios, but not on the same soundstage where the old Impact Zone was housed. It'll be a smaller space on the property. I don't know how much smaller you can get than the old Impact Zone, but I guess it's for the better. And the other thing TNA announced, they launched this new initiative called Where the Action Never Ends. It's this 24/7 cross-platform bullshit that they announced that reads very much like an idea Hulk Hogan had a couple of years ago. And I mocked him for this on the show, and I'll mock him for it again now. TNA's big idea that he was bandying about at the time, it was this game-changing idea that was going to change the face of TNA, and it was going to change their fortunes. And this grand idea that he had was for the fans, whenever you saw TNA wrestlers out in public, okay, so they're at the airport, they're walking down the street, they're at a restaurant, film them. Take your cell phone and film them. Take pictures of them, shoot video, and send it to TNA. Email it to the folks at Impact Wrestling. What purpose this would serve, I don't know. I assume that they would show it on television. That just sounded like a really bad idea to me. Okay? And certainly not an idea that was going to really do much to change TNA's fortunes. I guess maybe Hogan's thinking was, if enough people film these guys in public, they'll watch Impact because they'll want to see their footage on the TV show. I certainly hope that was not his logic, because that logic is stupid. So that idea never happened. This is not quite the same thing, but it's very similar. And essentially, it's going to be, when Impact is not on the air, you have all these other hours in the course of a week, right? So what we're going to do is, we're going to have the TNA talents themselves film themselves outside the ring. So it could be backstage, it could be at home with their family, training in the gym, wherever. Film themselves as a way to get people to learn more about them, to teach people more about who they are and who their characters are. I guess if you have a gimmick, stay in the gimmick, I guess, and just kind of do whatever you feel you need to do to help get yourself over and make people more aware of who you are. It's not the worst idea in the world. It's the sort of thing TNA should be doing themselves, but not the worst idea I've ever heard. Essentially, they're going to, I think in the press release, they said they're going to infuse this cameras everywhere footage into Impact. So we'll see some of this on the TV show, but for the other, you know, 166 hours of the week or whatever it is, you can go on YouTube, you can go on their Twitter page, Facebook. It's a social media initiative, basically. They want to get people more engaged, like WWE. I'm waiting for the TNA app. You know the app is coming at some point. Although for TNA, it'll probably just be Android and not iPhone or something like that. But it's meant to get people more actively engaged and, in theory, get some of the wrestlers over even more than they are now. Is it going to work? Probably not. But it's this new idea that they're gaga about. And quite frankly, I don't think it's going to make a damn bit of difference. I think if they just focus on their TV show and make their TV shows more entertaining and more appealing like they were a year ago. Because, I mean, there was a period of Impact where I thought Impact was a more enjoyable show than Raw. If you go back, and this is over a year ago now, but I really was more entertained by Impact on some weeks than I was on Raw. Raw was bore, and I would watch Impact, and it was like, all right, this is actually a pretty cool show. It's something different. I was into the characters. Maybe for me that was just the honeymoon period because it had been so long since I watched Impact consistently from week to week. And then eventually that bloom kind of fell off the rose. I don't know. I'm just speaking for myself here. They need to get back to that. If they could find a way to get back to that, and maybe Bischoff and Hogan being gone will help, then that's really where their concern should be right now. Because they're in a period of transition. This company is in a period of transition. They've got to make some real tough decisions about what they want to do, what direction they want to go in. They've got to plot, you know, business strategy, what the future is in terms of house shows and stuff. They've got like four house shows, I think, between now and the end of the year. Supposedly, they have every intention of ramping that up in 2014. So they're not going to completely ditch house shows. They're going to refocus on that business. Hey, if they feel that they can do that successfully, then by all means. But they're in a period of transition right now. They got bigger problems than filming guys behind the scenes to put on YouTube and Facebook. Watching Impact Thursday night, you could tell Bischoff wasn't there because gone was the ramp that extends from the entrance to the ring. That used to be an old WCW staple, and they used it for a while in TNA. They got rid of it, then they brought it back. I think that was it had to be an Eric Bischoff thing. I heard some people, you know, say, well, it was actually for Hulk Hogan because it was easier for him to get into the ring. I don't know if that's true or not, but it's gone. On this show, it was no longer there. And to me, that was a telltale sign that Bischoff was no longer there either. Show opened with Dixie Carter doing a complete 180. She comes out. She's got banners all over the place welcoming AJ Styles home. She's embracing him with open arms. A big celebration for AJ Styles as the new TNA World Heavyweight Champion. She gives him a new convertible right out of Triple H giving Randy Orton an Escalade. And anybody who denies that they're the same thing is just fooling themselves. The fingerprints are all over this thing in terms of what they're taking from WWE. They're not even trying to hide it anymore. So she got a convertible, I guess, instead of the Escalade that Orton got. AJ wasn't buying any of it. Bully Ray came out with Brooke. I thought Bully was actually really good here. He said, in pro wrestling, I'm a god, and if God was a bully, he'd be me. I thought that was a great line. Some people disagree with me, I noticed, and they say all Bully does is yell. All he does is yell. He's not really a good promo. He just yells to mask it. I think you're wrong. He does yell. He can be quite loud. But that doesn't mean it's a way of covering for him being a bad promo. You know, Jake the Snake Roberts had a style that was the complete opposite, where he would speak very low, right? He would speak very low, so you had to struggle to hear what he was saying. He would make you work hard to catch every single word that was coming out of his mouth. Bully takes a more, shall we say, blunt approach, a more in-your-face approach, and it works. It works for him. So I like Bully Ray when he's on his A-game when it comes to these promos. He attacked AJ Styles. He was about to powerbomb him through a table when suddenly the lights went out, and out came Mr. Anderson. Oh, yay. Anderson is back. Anderson went after Bully with some of the weakest-looking punches you've ever seen in your life. I'm begging Bret Hart to fly to Green Bay, Wisconsin, and spend a few hours with this man to show him how to throw a frickin' work punch. My God, was his offense terrible here. Crowd was into him. They were happy to see him back. But boy, the beginning and the end of the show especially, when he was throwing those punches at Bully Ray, I've seen newborns who can throw better punches than that. It just completely took me out of it. They come back from break. Anderson is still in the ring. He says he missed the fans. Dixie orders security to handcuff him and remove him from the building. Long story short, they handcuffed him. They took him away. But he would be back 90 minutes later. ODB and Velvet Sky lost to Gail Kim and Brooke. Gail Kim is the new Knockouts champion as of Bound for Glory. And with her, as her heavy, as her bodyguard, is Lady Tapa. Yet another comparison people are making. AJ Lee has Tamina Snuka as her bodyguard, her Samoan backup. And here's Gail Kim, the champion now for the Knockouts on TNA television with Lady Tapa. Another Samoan beast as her backup. I'm sure that's just a coincidence. Lady Tapa got involved here at the finish. She gave Velvet Sky a Yakuza kick, which allowed Gail Kim to get the pin for her team. Ethan Carter III, as I mentioned earlier, had another squash match on the show. He beat some guy named Dewey Barnes, who I believe does work for TNA in merchandising behind the scenes. I think he's also an indie wrestler. So Ethan Carter made short work of him. I think there's potential there for the EC3 character. He's having these short two-minute squashes, so it's not like we're really seeing much out of him. But he's Dixie Carter's nephew in storyline, so they must have big plans for him, one would think. I don't think they're going to be jobbing him out on television anytime soon. Kurt Angle came out for a promo on the show, talked about his match with Bobby Roode. Bobby Roode eventually came out, told this story about how he's lived with failure for 2 years after Kurt beat him at Bound for Glory 2 years ago. He finally got his revenge on Kurt at the pay-per-view. And Angle ended up punching Bobby Roode. Security got involved to break it up. We had the Bromans, new tag team champions, come out for a celebration, is what they were calling it. They had this DJ guy in the ring. I don't remember his name. Taz, for whatever reason, on commentary, kept calling him DJ Salami. I have no idea what the backstory is to that, nor do I want to know. He can keep that to himself, like that Triple H protein bar story from his DVD with Chris Jericho. Don't want to know. James Storm and Gunner eventually came out to rain on their parade. Bad Influence came out, so three of the teams that were involved in the gauntlet. Then eventually out comes the fourth one. We had Eric Young, Joseph Park. This all ended with Christopher Daniels smashing a champagne bottle over Joseph Park's head. This, of course, caused him to bleed. He morphed into the Monster Abyss, and he chased them to the back. And we had Joseph Park. Joseph Park gave Jesse Godders, I think it was, a choke slam here. This was a great choke slam. I just had to comment on that. He choke slammed the shit out of this guy. And that was pretty much it. Not much of this segment. They're keeping these four teams together, I guess. I don't know if they're going to do another four-way or not, but it was entertaining enough. The main event was AJ Styles and Bully Ray in a rematch from Bound for Glory. TNA World Heavyweight title on the line. Not nearly as good as their pay-per-view match. If their pay-per-view match was very good, this was maybe good. This was certainly passable, but nothing like what the pay-per-view was. Anderson ended up coming back out. He got involved. That factored into the finish, and Bully Ray ended up getting pinned. So Anderson and Ray, they brawl when the match is over. Dixie Carter says, "Oh, no, don't go anywhere. I'm coming out right now. I'm going to get you to sign a new contract." And out comes Dixie. She confronts AJ Styles. And she's ready to give him the keys to the castle, everything he could ever want. Money, the convertible, it's all his. And AJ admits, you know, it's an amazing offer that you're making me, but It's put together by a horrible human being. He was not buying into what Dixie was selling. He quite literally wiped his ass with the contract that she handed him. And he ended up taking the car keys anyway, said he was out of here, took the title, got in the convertible, and drove off. And that was the end of Impact on Thursday. So, three matches on the entire show. A lot of people accusing TNA of ripping off the CM Punk storyline from 2011 with this AJ Styles stuff. If you read the spoilers for Thursday's Halloween Impact coming up this week, and if you didn't, and you don't want to know anything about that show, skip ahead, okay? You've been warned. But if you did read the spoilers, there is no denying it anymore. They are ripping this shit right from the Punk playbook 2 years ago. Right down to Dixie announcing this Thursday that there would be a tournament to crown a new TNA World Heavyweight Champion. The tournament will kick off the following week on Impact with Samoa Joe, Austin Aries, Jeff Hardy, James Storm, Chris Sabin, Bobby Roode, Kurt Angle, and Magnus, who wins a gauntlet match on the show coming up this Thursday to earn the final spot in the tournament. Sure seems like the perfect setup for Magnus to win the title here. But wow, they're not even trying to hide it, you know? AJ's unhappy, he's got no contract, he wins the title, he walks out on the evil owner, now they announce a tournament to crown a new champion. At least Dixie doesn't have an egomaniacal son-in-law to come in and beat AJ in a match. But it's WWE light. That's the best way I can describe it. Some TNA fans may find that insulting, but that there's just no other way to put it. They have a real opportunity to be different, to offer a real alternative to the crap we see on Mondays, and instead they're ripping off all of the main storylines from the other show. If that isn't WWE light, then I don't know what is. And if TNA insists on being WWE light, then they're doomed to fail. You can't out WWE WWE. They will fail. If that's what they want, then by all means, please continue doing what you're doing. But it's like making a copy of a copy. You know what I mean? They're making a photocopy of something that's only 2 years old. It's still fresh in people's minds. They're not copying off an angle from 10, 15, 20 years ago here. They're dooming themselves to failure. No matter what they do, it will come off as second rate compared to what the other guys did. The only way, if they insist on doing this, that they can maybe make this a little bit better, do the one thing that WWE never did, that they never pulled the trigger on, and I always thought that was a big mistake. A, bringing Punk back too quickly, and B, not letting Punk follow up on his promise to take the championship with him to other wrestling shows. He did pop up on some indie show. I don't even think he had the belt with him. But I mean, show up. Show up at a Ring of Honor show. Show up at some other indie show. Go to Japan. Right? He kind of teased doing that in that pipe bomb promo, but he never did. Well, TNA could let AJ Styles do that. Maybe have AJ Styles go over to Japan and defend the championship in Japan. Go to AAA in Mexico. I think TNA has a working relationship with AAA. Let him go down there and defend the TNA title in a match. There was a meeting in Nashville back over the summer. Remember, they posted this on the Impact Wrestling website. It was the great Muda, who now is running a promotion in Japan called Wrestle One. He had this meeting with TNA executives, with Jeff Jarrett. You know, there was Muda in the photo, I think, wearing a suit, and Jeff Jarrett's wearing like a freaking polo shirt. Like, oh, so nice of you to dress up for the occasion. But yeah, they had that meeting. I don't think anything ever came of it, but there may be a working relationship there. Maybe he can go to Muda's promotion over in Japan and work a match. You know, at least try. If you insist on doing this, at least try to make it as believable as possible. That's the one thing TNA could do that WWE, in my opinion, dropped the ball on. But I just hope that the end game here is not AJ Styles telling Dixie Carter, I'll come back, but only if you bring back Hulk Hogan. Bring Hulk Hogan back to power, and then I'll come back. Because they won't mention Hogan's name on TV, but they sure do still reference him a lot. I just hope that is not the plan. Because then it just becomes all about Hulk Hogan again. It doesn't serve any good purpose. It's time for a monster mailbag here on this Halloween edition of the Sound Off. If you have audio questions, you can email them to me at thesolomonster@gmail.com. MP3 format only. Try to keep them to about 30 seconds or so. And always remember to please include the text of your question in the body of your email along with your attachment. Before we move on here, I want to give a quick shout-out to one of our loyal listeners, Patrick W. Phillips. Patrick has a debut novel that is now available called The Deadly Game We Play. It's available exclusively on Amazon Kindle, all Kindle apps, for just $3.99. It's a story of empathy, apathy, and violent infatuation. Sounds like my relationship with WWE. Tells a story of two young detectives as they battle a mad heiress in a world where Tommy guns and trench coats are back in style. And one can only hope that common sense is back in style in the wrestling world, too. The book actually has a few wrestling tie-ins, hence why I'm mentioning it here. One of the main characters is a closet wrestling fan with a replica championship belt in her room, so we won't judge her for that. A pair of characters take on the aliases of Edge and Christian at one point. So you can head over to Amazon.com or Kindle and punch up The Deadly Game We Play. He's even got a wrestling tie-in in the title. Look at that. I wish they would do another Deadly Game tournament. It's only $3.99 right now. Patrick is a big fan of the show, so please show your support for him and check out his first novel. Flint in Beijing writes in, "One difference I noticed between TNA and WWE is that in TNA, the character being portrayed usually gets over as compared to WWE, where it's an entrance, a theme song, or a catchphrase that tends to get over more than the wrestlers themselves. What is TNA doing right that is going unnoticed?" I don't want to paint with a broad brush here, like every person in TNA is over and WWE has no guys with a real connection to the audience, because that's just not true. But I think, you know, Flint makes a valid point here. In a lot of those cases in TNA, take like an Austin Aries, for example, or a Samoa Joe, it's not really a gimmick, right? They're playing a character on TV, but those guys are largely left to their own devices to just be themselves and go out there and wrestle and do their thing. That's how Joe got himself over when he first came in, and is still over. Somehow, by the grace of God for this guy, he's still over with the audience. When he got kidnapped and came back with a tattoo on his face, waving a fucking machete around, surprise, surprise, he wasn't as over. Austin Aries was allowed to go out there. He got a little push, right, as the X Division champion, and have awesome matches every single week. They just let him go out there and do his thing. And that endeared him to the fans. Same thing with Daniel Bryan in WWE. But they're turning Bryan into nothing more than a gimmick, as he relies on this yes chant more and more, and they don't let him go out there and cut promos like that WWE.com promo I played a little bit of earlier. That's the sort of thing he should be doing on his own on television. Not some 3-minute video that only so many people are going to see on their YouTube channel. So that's the fastest way to drive something into the ground, is to just turn it into a gimmick, nothing more, and hey, it works, so let's just run with it. Everybody loves the yes chant, so let's have him do it in every promo, and let's have Big Show go out there and do it until it's just not cool anymore. Yeah, there's a reason that DX didn't go out there telling people to know their role and shut their mouth, because that wasn't their shtick, that wasn't their catchphrase. But in WWE, it's true. It's more about your character and how you're packaged. CM Punk, I think, would be the exception to that, but by and large, I think that is true. RJ wants to know, what was the full story between Karma and Bubba the Love Sponge? Why did she go crazy on him? Yeah, this was back in 2010. Hulk Hogan brought his buddy, surprise, surprise, Bubba the Love Sponge, who's a radio shock jock, brought him into TNA. Bubba had made some offensive remarks on his Twitter about an earthquake in Haiti that killed well over 100,000 people. He said, you know, saying, fuck Haiti, and he referred to all those deaths as a cleanse. The guy's so full of shit, he probably could benefit from a cleanse himself. So Kong was so bothered by these comments when she found out about them. When she saw him backstage at Impact, she attacked him. She just started wailing away on him. She was screaming, this is for Haiti, this is for Haiti, which is kind of funny, actually. I could just picture this monstrous, crazy woman just slapping the shit out of Bubba the Love Sponge while shouting, this is for Haiti. There's just something very funny about that to me. She was leading efforts to collect donations for earthquake relief, so it was a cause that meant something to her, and his comments just set her off, I guess. And a couple of months later, she was let go by TNA, and thankfully, Bubba the Love Schmuck was also gone from TNA not long after that. This question comes from Daniel. Since the WWE title is the main title for the company, do you think the World Heavyweight Championship is essentially a practice title now? Like they are giving guys a shot who they think have the potential to one day hold the WWE title. No, I don't think so at all. There's no evidence to back that up. Look at who the world champion is right now. Look who the champion's been since June. Alberto Del Rio, who's already been WWE champion, and he was a failure in that role. And better yet, I bet if you take a look, you know what, let me bring up, I'm going to bring up a list of the last 10 or so world champions, and let's see the names. That might be a better way to prove whether it's used as a practice title or not, because I say no, but let's see here. Trusty Wikipedia here. Okay, Hold on a second. Okay, here we go. List of World Heavyweight Champions, WWE. Let's skip to the end of the list here. And Alberto Del Rio is the current World Heavyweight Champion. Now, if you go back before Del Rio, okay, Dolph Ziggler was the World Champion for all of 2 months. Dolph would be a good example of somebody who, in theory, maybe they would put the world title on him, see how he does, and then one day maybe he's good enough to be WWE champion. But they took the title off him very quickly, and it hasn't been back on him since. And that really wasn't the purpose of putting the title on him in the first place. But let's say Dolph. Okay, Dolph, we can put maybe in that category. Before Dolph, Del Rio had it. The Big Show, I don't think they're grooming the Big Show to be WWE champion. Oh, maybe they are, actually. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe Big Show is going to be the WWE champion. Maybe that last world title run for the Big Show was just to see if that young guy was good enough to be WWE champion for the umpteenth time. Who knows? Before Big Show, it was Sheamus, who was already a top guy, already been WWE champion, so that's not why they put the world title on him. Daniel Bryan, who they took the title off in 18 seconds. I don't think the idea behind putting the title on him was to see if he was good enough with the big belt. I don't buy that for a second. Before him, again, the Big Show. Before him, Mark Henry. Before him, Randy Orton. Before him came Christian, who they were never, ever going to put the WWE title on. And then you start getting back into guys like Edge. So there is no evidence that I can tell here. Dolph Ziggler, maybe, but that's a stretch. Because like I said, I don't think that was the idea behind putting the world title on him. There is no indication that the world title is being used as a springboard for the WWE title. And that right there, in and of itself, is completely ridiculous. The Intercontinental title was always looked at as the stepping stone to the WWE Championship. That's fine, because the Intercontinental title was always, by design, the secondary title. Maybe they just need to change the name of the belt. Maybe that's why I'm so worked up about it. Maybe instead of calling it the World Heavyweight Championship, they should just call it the Triple H Memorial Belt, because that was the belt that he took out of a briefcase, remember, back in 2002. That was the birth, the genesis of that championship. He took it out of a briefcase and started defending it. Call it the Triple H Memorial Belt, and I guarantee you that belt will start being positioned as the top title in the company. I guarantee you that. David from Sacramento, California writes in, my question is in relation to WWE Slammy Awards. Did they ever host the Slammys as its own TV special and not just a special episode of Raw? If it has or hasn't, do you think when WWE brings it back in the future, it should be either a half hour or hour long special on its own with no wrestling? I know winning a Slammy does not really mean much, but it would be cool to have it held similar to the Grammys. Yes, it's kayfabe, but do you think WWE fans would care more for it if it were presented that way? Yeah, I do. I think the Slammys had four TV specials. 86, 87, 96, 97. Those were the years. I know the one in 86 aired on MTV. You can find that one on YouTube. And you should, because it features one of the worst lip-syncing performances you'll ever see, with Hillbilly Jim singing Don't Go Messing With the Country Boy. That whole first Slammy special was built around the wrestling album. That's why probably it was on MTV. And so they had different musical performances with, you know, Gene Okerlund singing a song and Jimmy Hart singing a song and JYD sung Grab Them Cakes, which was actually quite fun, if I remember that. So that was the one in 86. The one in 87 is probably my favorite one. They had an awesome brawl between Harley Race and Jim Duggan with Bobby Heenan. He was involved doing comedy spots and stuff. Gorilla Monsoon was essentially on a microphone providing impromptu commentary off camera for the whole thing. They go all over the backstage area. It was great. It was great. The ones in 96 and 97, they have Todd Pettengill, who was the Michael Cole of his era. Take that as a compliment or an insult, however you want. He would sing these Slammy songs, which were actually very creative and very clever. He would work in all the different wrestlers and put this whole song together about them at the beginning of the show. I think the one in 97, yeah, because Rocky Maivia wasn't around at that time in 96. The one in 97 had The Rock winning Rookie of the Year. And Steve Austin, instead, he walks up on stage and he talks about how many times Rocky must have voted for himself to win the award. I always laughed at that. I would prefer to see the Slammies as a separate special, more along the lines of those shows, absolutely. I think that could be very entertaining. The way they do it now, it's just, it's kind of pointless. You know, they may as well not even bother doing them. But now, they have the app. So you know full well that in 2 months, they're going to bring the Slammy Awards back, and they're going to go hog wild on that stupid app with their fan voting. You just wait and see. Bruno, from Miami, regarding last week's podcast where you brought up how much WWE has profited from sponsorships during the PG era, I know they recently canceled Saturday Morning Slam, which was a PG-oriented show, but do you still think they should create more shows that are PG-oriented and instead make Raw and SmackDown more appealing to the older demographic? I was hoping that that was their plan when they relaunched the ECW brand, but it never happened. You know, you can't do it that way because of, I guess, the promises they made to their sponsors. Raw and SmackDown are their main shows. You can't create these secondary shows that are only going to have a fraction of the audience and then make Raw and SmackDown, let's say, TV-14. It doesn't work that way. You're going to lose those sponsors in a heartbeat because those sponsors know the money is in Raw and SmackDown. Those are your two flagship shows. Those shows have to stay PG no matter what. You know, it would have to be the other way around. You keep Raw and SmackDown as is, and for better or worse, and then create a separate show that airs late at night that's more adult-oriented. That they may be able to get away with. But it's probably a risk. Even that's probably a risk. You know, they have to make a decision. Either you're PG or you're not. They've decided we're PG, and that's fine. But that means everything has to be PG, or else you piss off the wrong people. I mean, everybody gets their undies in a bunch these days about something. All it takes is one parents group who sees something that they don't like, and then they start this Twitter and this Facebook campaign to get them kicked off the air, and it's a whole big thing, and they don't want that. They don't want the headache. Lastly, John from California. I recently was watching the 1993 Survivor Series, and the one match that always sticks in my mind was the Hart family against Shawn Michaels and the Knights. I remember Jerry Lawler was originally advertised as the team captain for his Knights against the Hart family. Why did Shawn Michaels replace Lawler for that match? It just didn't make any sense to me at the time. Lawler was indicted on rape charges. He was actually, I think, charges of rape and sodomy on a 13-year-old girl. Those charges were dropped. And I think what happened is the girl ended up admitting that she made the whole thing up. So they dropped the charges. Lawler ended up coming back on commentary for WrestleMania 10 with Vince McMahon. So he was gone for a number of months there. Interestingly, Lawler did plead guilty to harassing a witness. I had to look this up, but the witness was a 14-year-old girl who was going to, I guess, testify against him. She was prepared to do that, and I believe Lawler called her up. He got her phone number somehow. Here's the thing about Jerry Lawler. Jerry Lawler, when he says, oh, I'm the king of Memphis, he really is. The guy is Teflon. The guy has had so many problems over the years. I remember reading there was one time I think he rode over like a traffic cop's foot, some woman or something. I mean, maybe it was an accident. It seems like every time he gets in trouble, he gets off. He's Teflon in that town. He really is. He walks around like the king. And God knows what he's probably gotten away with over the years. Probably from speeding tickets to God knows what. Lawler somehow got this girl's number, called her up at home to speak with her. You can't do that. She's a witness. And so he was put on probation for 2 years as a result of that. The charges in the actual case were dropped. He came back and it was never spoken of again. We have a quick little breaking news update here. I just noticed, and I want to mention it. The Intercontinental Championship match on the Hell in a Cell pre-show is, in fact, off. That would be why it disappeared from the website earlier. It's off because of an undisclosed injury to the Intercontinental Champion, Curtis Axel. So Axel is hurt. The match is canceled. I don't see anything about a replacement match, so I don't know what their plan is for the pre-show, but that is now official. According to WWE, there will be no Intercontinental Championship match tonight. In the spirit of Halloween, we are celebrating WCW Halloween Havoc this week in wrestling history. And boy, why the hell has WWE never used the Halloween Havoc name? I heard they may be bringing back Bash at the Beach next year, but between this and them not using War Games, Vince McMahon is one stubborn SOB. Anyway, you want to talk about frightening things in wrestling. WCW served up plenty of horrific moments to its fans over the years. To begin, we go back 23 years ago, October 27, 1991. The infamous Chamber of Horrors match. Never has a name for a match been more appropriate. It was two teams pitted against each other. Elegante, Sting, and the Steiner Brothers beat Abdullah the Butcher, the Diamond Stud, Cactus Jack, and Big Van Vader in the first, and I believe only, thankfully, ever Chamber of Horrors match. The match ended when Sting was put in an electric chair that was inside this chamber, okay, this cage. And they were going to flip the switch to essentially fry Sting in the middle of the ring. They were going to electrocute him. Sting ended up pulling Abdullah the Butcher into the chair instead, and he was the one who got electrocuted. And you can picture him sitting in the chair, jiggling all over from the electric volts coursing through his body. This was shit. This was WCW in 1991. 19 years ago this week, on October 23rd, 1994, Hacksaw Jim Duggan beat Steve Austin in a match at Halloween Havoc, and Brutus Beefcake was later revealed at the end of the show to be the masked man who attacked Hulk Hogan after the main event. It's good to be friends with the Hulkster, brother. Speaking of the Hulkster, he beat Ric Flair inside a steel cage with Mr. T as the guest referee. I think it was in Hogan's contract that he can never lose a match to Ric Flair. I'm almost convinced there had to be a clause somewhere in that contract in WCW. Sure seemed like it. Stipulation was that if Flair lost, he would have to retire. So naturally, he was back a few months later. But it's amazing to me to look at this card from that 1994 period. You know, Steve Austin, stunning Steve Austin on the upswing as a single star, and he has to do the job to Hacksaw Jim Duggan and Brutus Beefcake, Ed Leslie, the Disciple, the Zodiac, the Booty Man, whatever name you want to call this guy. He's this big reveal at the end of the show just because he's buddies with Hulk Hogan. It's just hilarious to me. 15 years ago this week, on October 25th, 1998, speaking of Hulk Hogan and disasters in WCW, WCW had the great distinction of hosting a match that Eric Bischoff himself referred to as one of the worst matches in history. And Gene Okerlund referred to it as a disaster, which is rare because Gene Okerlund and Hulk Hogan are good friends, and for him to call the match a disaster, you know it was bad. And yet it involved two of the biggest names in wrestling history. It's the infamous Halloween Havoc match between Hulk Hogan and the Ultimate Warrior. Thankfully, the only big match Warrior ever did for WCW. Also, that Hulk Hogan could get his win back 8 years after WrestleMania 6. He could not live that down, that loss at WrestleMania to the Warrior. He just had to get the win back. I remember reading that Hogan also really wanted to get Yokozuna at one point into WCW so that he could get his win back over him as well, but Yokozuna died before that could ever happen. I don't know how true that is, but it would not surprise me in the least. The less said about this match, the better. It sucked. Hogan got his win back. There was an embarrassing spot involving Hogan attempting to use a fireball on the Warrior, but he couldn't get the flash paper to ignite, and so Warrior just stood there like an idiot. And then when Hogan finally did get it to light, it singed off his own eyebrows. You can't make this shit up. Lost in all of this was an awesome main event for the WCW Championship between Bill Goldberg and Diamond Dallas Page, which may be Goldberg's greatest match. If it isn't, it's certainly top three of all time involving Goldberg. And when I say lost in all of this, I mean that literally. It's a lost match that never was seen by many people who order the pay-per-view unless they watch Nitro the next night. When WCW replayed the entire match for free. Reason being, the pay-per-view went long, and many cable systems cut the show off during the Hogan-Warrior match, so people missed the finish of that match and the entire main event. They missed the entire Goldberg-DDP title match. I still maintain the Hogan-Warrior match was so bad, it was a mercy killing by these cable systems. They did it on purpose. The show also featured a match between Kevin Nash and Scott Hall as part of a storyline that actually touched on Scott Hall's very real issues with alcohol, so you stay classy, WCW. And finally, ending the Halloween Havoc theme, 14 years ago this week, on October 24, 1999, this particular Halloween Havoc was the first WCW pay-per-view of the Vince Russo and Ed Ferrara era. And surprise, surprise, you had tons of swerves and bullshit finishes. This was not one of WCW's finer shows. Bill Goldberg beat Sid Vicious to win the U.S. title after the referee stopped the match due to Sid's excessive blood loss. Yet later in the show, Goldberg came out for an unannounced WCW World Heavyweight Championship match against Sting, where he beat Sting in 3 minutes to win the title. This was after Sting beat Hulk Hogan earlier in the show in about 3 seconds. When Hogan walked to the ring, Hogan whispered something to Sting that we, the listener, the audience, could not hear. And then he just laid down, and he let Sting pin him. And then he walked to the back. And the next year, Russo recycled the same bullshit finish with Jeff Jarrett laying down for Hogan and dropping the title to him at the Bash at the Beach show before their little work shoot went straight to hell. And Russo swerved Hogan and cut a shoot promo on him instead. Remember those pay-per-view ads WCW ran during the legendary Vince Russo-Bill Goldberg feud, where the voiceover said, you know, last time Goldberg refused to follow the script. He refused to follow the script. Buy our next pay-per-view because he may break from the script again. And Dixie Carter let this man book her product for how many years before finally letting him go? Idiots. Every last one of them. Idiots. 18 years ago this week, October 22nd, 1995, WWE held an In Your House pay-per-view from Winnipeg. You idiot. Sorry. It's one of my favorite Chris Jericho lines. No, Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada. This was a horrible show. And really, that comes straight from Vince McMahon himself. Don't take my word for it. Vince was so disgusted by the time this main event had ended on this show that when the pay-per-view faded to black, he threw down his glasses and his headset, and he muttered the word, horrible, as he walked off. And he walked off while there was still a pull-apart brawl going on inside the ring with Bret Hart and Diesel. Bret had been on commentary for the main event of Diesel versus the British Bulldog, as Bret was going to meet the winner for the championship the following month at Survivor Series. Diesel and the Bulldog had truly one of the worst pay-per-view main events in WWE history. This was just painful to watch. All Bulldog did for 20 minutes was just put Diesel in leg locks. And then for a finish, Diesel shoved Bret Hart at ringside, which caused Bret to run in and go after him for the DQ. Everything about this sucked. Thankfully, they took the title off Diesel a month later, and after a year-long reign, no less. Also on this show, Shawn Michaels showed up to forfeit his Intercontinental Championship after getting the shit beaten out of him for real outside a bar in Syracuse, New York the week before. And boy, did he look like hell when he came out on this pay-per-view. What happened is, apparently he was hanging out with Davey Boy Smith and Sean Waltman at a bar in Syracuse. They may have actually been in a car outside the bar when this happened. There's a few differing accounts about exactly how it all started, but there was a woman involved in some form or fashion, naturally. And Michaels ended up getting assaulted by 10 guys, not 9. They said it was 9 guys on television, but apparently it was 10. And it was pretty brutal stuff, too. Michaels had both of his eyes swollen shut. He needed 10 stitches. And he had to have his eyelids sewn back on after it was nearly ripped off. He did not, however, suffer a concussion, which was the whole storyline when he came back to TV. If you remember, he collapsed on that one Raw show during a match with Owen Hart. From what they said was post-concussion syndrome. He came back too fast from his injuries. And they built to this heroic return at the 1996 Royal Rumble. He never actually had a concussion, but he did get beaten up. That much is for sure. I think Bulldog may have gotten scratched up a little bit. Sean Waltman was fine, but Michaels got the worst of it. So out he came to surrender the title to Dean Douglas. Instead of putting the title up in a match between Douglas and Razor Ramon, they just gave the championship to Dean Douglas. So he is on the books as having been the Intercontinental Champion. And they brought out Razor Ramon immediately to wrestle Douglas for the title. And Ramon beat him. He pinned Dean Douglas, even though Douglas's foot was under the bottom rope. And so Razor Ramon became what I believe was the first 4-time Intercontinental Champion in WWE history. So Douglas, the heel, was legitimately screwed in this match and had the Intercontinental title for all of 15 minutes. I think he still may be the shortest reigning Intercontinental Champion of all time. They showed multiple replays after the match of Douglas sticking his leg out under the bottom rope before the 3 count, to where even Vince McMahon and Jim Ross on commentary were forced to acknowledge it. And then it was like, oh well, moving on. When Douglas complains that the click had it in for him during his run there, he ain't kidding. This show is also notable for the debut of Gold Dust against Marty Jannetty. There's a little trivia note for you. 17 years ago this week, on October 21, 1996, Bret the Hitman Hart, who had been off WWE television since WrestleMania 12, and he was tempting a very lucrative offer to jump to WCW, instead ended up signing a landmark 20-year deal with Vince McMahon, one that would guarantee him a front office position once his wrestling days were over. He made the announcement live on Monday Night Raw. They played it up like nobody knew what his decision was going to be. Not even Vince McMahon. Obviously, McMahon already knew that he was staying, but he did a great job of acting very relieved on commentary once Bret made the announcement. That 20-year deal lasted all of 1 year after Vince gave Bret permission to negotiate a deal with Eric Bischoff many months later because WWE was having financial troubles. And according to Vince, he told Bret, "We can't afford to honor your contract." Vince eventually went back to Bret a little while later and told him that business had started to turn around, and all of a sudden now he could pay for his contract, but by then it was too late, and Bret had already made the deal with WCW, which would, of course, lead to the Montreal Screwjob, which would lead to the birth of the Mr. McMahon character, and a great period of prosperity for WWE. Bret did not have that same level of prosperity, unfortunately. He got paid well, that's for sure. But WCW did not know what to do with him, and then his brother died, and then he got kicked in the head by Bill Goldberg and was forced to retire. Then he fell off his bike and suffered a stroke a couple of years later, so it was just one series of unfortunate events for Bret after that, just one after the other after the other. 12 years ago this week, on October 22nd, 2001, Hayabusa, one of the most popular Japanese wrestlers at the time and the top star of Atsushi Onita's FMW promotion, where he wrestled a lot of barbed wire and exploding death matches and that sort of thing. He was wrestling a match against Mammoth Sasaki in Tokyo when one move went horribly wrong and resulted in Hayabusa being paralyzed from the neck down. He was attempting a quebrada, which is a move made popular in WCW and WWE by Chris Jericho as the Lion Salt, when he slipped while executing the move. The middle rope, I guess, was very loose, and so he slipped. He fell onto the bottom rope, where he tried to springboard himself from the bottom rope instead, but he was too low to the ground, and he landed right on top of his head. The match stopped dead. The footage on YouTube is just eerie as hell when you watch it. They rushed him to the hospital. Later on, they announced that he was paralyzed. He cracked two of his vertebrae. FMW was really never the same after that. The promotion folded the following year. In the years since the accident, he did recover to the point that he could at least stand up on his own, but obviously he never wrestled again. He actually popped up backstage at a WWE show several years ago to meet with some old friends, and he took a picture while he was there with Vince and Shane McMahon, which you could find if you Google it. 7 years ago this week, on October 22nd, 2006, TNA Bound for Glory, Jeff Jarrett defended his NWA World Heavyweight Championship against Sting in a title versus career match with Kurt Angle as the special enforcer. Sting won the title after no-selling a guitar shot and making Jarrett tap out to the Scorpion Deathlock. This win was Sting's first championship win in TNA and also gives him the distinction of being the only man in history to hold the NWA title before the birth of TNA as well as after the promotion was created. 4 years ago this week, on October 25th, 2009, was the first ever WWE bragging rights pay-per-view. Concept was a bunch of interpromotional matches, and I do use that term loosely, interpromotional. But it would pit Raw guys against SmackDown guys. Team SmackDown beat Team Raw to win the bragging rights trophy. Also, John Cena beat Randy Orton. 6 falls to 5 in a 60-minute Iron Man match to recapture the WWE Championship. I know the idea of John Cena in a marathon match is frightening to most people, but he had that great 55-minute match with Shawn Michaels in the UK, and I thought this match was really good too. They held my interest most of the way through. I think it's one of the better Iron Man matches that the company has ever had. 2 days later, on October 27th, 2009, Hulk Hogan and TNA made the joint announcement that Hulk Hogan had signed with the promotion. Press conference was held at Madison Square Garden, of all places. Originally, it was billed to the public as a promotional event for Hulk Hogan's book, but it was a swerve. So I wonder if Vince Russo booked the press conference. Eric Bischoff was there. He introduced Hogan. Hogan said he was becoming a partner in the company, some partner he turned out to be. This was when Dixie Carter made her famous comment referring to Hulk Hogan as the rocket fuel.
Just needed that little bit of rocket fuel.
That TNA needed to get to that next level.
Little bit of rocket fuel.
Little bit of rocket fuel.
Little bit.
Only a little bit, not too much.
Little bit.
We're all still waiting for that rocket to take off. And finally, 3 years ago this week, on October 23rd, 2010, Brock Lesnar got his ass kicked by Cain Velasquez and lost via TKO in the first round of their fight with 15 seconds left to go at UFC 121, losing his UFC heavyweight title in the process. This was the night that Brock Lesnar had his infamous run-in with The Undertaker, where Lesnar walked right past Taker as he was doing an interview, Taker was, with Ariel Helwani. Both guys stared at each other for a few seconds. Taker asked Brock, "You want to do it?" Likely trying to set up an angle for a WrestleMania match. Vince McMahon wanted the match. Brock Lesnar supposedly wanted the match very badly, even though he was still under contract to UFC. Ultimately, Dana White would not allow it, so it didn't happen. And now, here we are all these years later, and we could very well end up seeing Brock Lesnar and The Undertaker at next year's WrestleMania in New Orleans. And that's this week in wrestling history. If you have questions for the mailbag, audio or text, email them to me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. I read everything. I try to respond to as many people directly as I can. If not, I'll try to get to your question here on the show. So please keep writing in to me. And who knows, you keep writing in and maybe one of your questions will end up on episode 300 in a couple of weeks. Follow me on Twitter, @Solomonster is my handle on there. I will likely be doing some live blogging during the Hell in a Cell pay-per-view tonight. I do that for Raw every single Monday night. So please follow me on there. Facebook.com/TheSolomonster is our official Facebook profile page. There is now a special sound-off Halloween-themed logo up, just for this week only. It's a little something I had put together a while back that I thought I would put up for the week in celebration of Halloween, so you could check out our new cover photo on there. And don't forget, we have a fan page. Please like us on Facebook. And we have a closed group that you will have to apply for membership for, but I will approve you, I promise you. So find the official Solomonster Sounds Off Facebook group and join us there, over 630 members and counting. And we have a Sound Off YouTube channel as well. My username is The Solomonster, all one word. I am aiming to get a new YouTube video up this week, probably on Monday afternoon if I can, a Hell in a Cell wrap-up. So if you don't want to wait all week until the next Sound Off for my thoughts on the pay-per-view this weekend, I should be able to get a YouTube video up on Monday at some point. And if you subscribe to our official channel, once that video goes up, you will be made aware of it. You'll find other reviews on there. I've done reviews for the Bob Holly book, The Hardcore Truth, for Triple H's new Thy Kingdom Come DVD. I did a review for the Battleground pay-per-view last month, and there'll be more to come. So please subscribe to us on YouTube as well. And you can buy a shirt in the Sound Off Superstore, solomonster.spreadshirt.com. Still the best way to support the show is through PayPal donations on thesolomonster.com. Spare what you can. Every little bit helps. And that's going to wrap up this year's Halloween-themed edition of the Solomonster Sounds Off. Thank you all for tuning in this week. This is a big show. Next weekend, episode 299. We're getting awfully close. And as always, be well, stay safe, have a safe Halloween if you're going to go out trick-or-treating, or if you're too old for that, if you're just going to go get drunk off your ass still, be well, stay safe. And we'll see you back next week. And until then, take care, guys.
You've been listening to the Solomonster Sounds Off, giving you the good. The bad.
Raw is now 3 hours every Monday at 8.
And the ugly.
Hello. Why does Jerry Lawler insist on telling us that we are just getting started? What the fuck have I been watching for the past 2 hours?
Well, mostly the good.
I don't want to K-fab you.
You're going to K-fab me?
Solomonster Sounds Off.
Since 2007, on thesolomonster.com, iTunes, and Stitcher Radio, The Solomonster Sounds Off.